The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for so many years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return to the November 2021 issue of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. We've read all about the 11 places to get the sweetest slices of the season. And then we've gone on to cabins and cottages. But this is the last reading of the month. So you know what that means? We start out with the decades series. The current decade for the year 2021 is the 1970s, the decade of disruption. So I'll be reading from that. Just a little notice when you hear me go or something like that. I am still recovering from a cold and have a cough and have a bottle of water here that I hope will stave off any coughing. But if it goes silent for a while, you'll know I'm hacking away here while the microphone off button is pressed. We hope that doesn't happen. A seat on the bench. From her roots in Reidsville, Susie Sharp blazes a trail to the North Carolina Supreme Court, becoming the first female Chief Justice in state history. Written as always by Philip Gerard. In the popular imagination, cultural pioneers often stand larger than life, charismatic figures who blaze a trail through adversity by sheer force of conviction and personality. Susie Marshall Sharp is the antithesis of that archetype in nearly every way, yet her career becomes a record of milestones achieved, barriers broken, and new precedents set, in that most traditionally, in that most traditionally male profession, the law. Sharp is the eldest of 10 children born to James Merritt Jim Sharp, the son of a Civil War veteran and farmer who read law and, after a series of false starts, set up a legal office in Reidsville. And Annie Britt Blackwell Sharp, descended from slaveholding aristocracy. While still a teenager, Sharp decides to pursue her father's profession, despite the fact that there are almost no female attorneys in the state. To follow that path, she also determines that she will never marry. She is almost deliberately plain, in high school wearing nondescript clothes and wire-rimmed glasses, her dark hair combed back from her round face and tied with an unfashionably large bow. Yet something about her resonates with her peers, who elect her president of the ninth grade girls. Thus begins a pattern that will endure throughout her life. She inspires trust and friendship, not through showing off or being a life of the party, but by radiating a kind of quiet confidence, a sureness of her own abilities. She becomes a skilled debater and salutatorian of her class. But even so, she's already grounded in self-knowledge, smart but not overbearing, her considerable ambition anchored in both intellectual ability and integrity. In 1926, she enrolls at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill Law School, which since 1911 has graduated only three women as the only woman in a class of about 60. She endures hazing from her male classmates. In class, she does not put herself forward. Just as later, as an attorney, she comports herself with keen composure rather than brashness, so as not to ruffle the egos of her male adversaries. But outside of class, her affable wit earns her many friends and admirers among her male peers. Ultimately, she is named to Law Review. She is one of just two in her cohort to be awarded the prestigious Order of the Coif and graduates with honors. Yet, despite her own successes in male-dominated spaces, she is not a feminist and opposes the Equal Rights Amendment. She is most often described as petite, a traditionally southern woman who enjoys gentlemanly courtesies but secretly carries a loaded pistol in her handbag. She never weds, but engages discreetly in several extended love affairs, one with a married professor who has two children. She arranges for her own love letters to be destroyed or returned to her to avoid scandal. She resolutely keeps her private life separate from her public persona. She recoils from the hurly-burly of politics, but works effectively for the Democratic Party, which has dominated the legislature and courts throughout the 20th century. She is especially keen to see women get involved in politics and galvanizes the support of women in Rockingham County to help elect Governor R. Greg Cherry in 1944. For two decades, she represents black and white clients in partnership with her father as a part of Sharp and Sharp and becomes the first woman to serve as a city attorney in North Carolina. In 1949, Governor W. Carr Scott names her to the Superior Court bench, the first woman to hold that position. Then, in 1962, Governor Terry Sanford appoints her to the Supreme Court, the first woman ever to serve on the state's highest court. Sanford recalls decades later, "The selection of Susie Sharp to be a member of the Supreme Court was the most widely approved appointment that I ever made." The 1972 elections sweep into office a Republican governor, James E. Holzhauser, Jr., with the power to fill upcoming vacancies in every court with Republicans. And a 1972 referendum mandates the justice retire at age 72. Chief Justice William Haywood Bobbitt coincidentally turns 72 that very year. He chooses to finish out his term rather than retiring under a Democratic governor who can appoint his successor. So, in 1974, for the first time since 1902, a new Chief Justice will be elected. The Chief Justice not only guides the deliberations of the Supreme Court, but it will control the administrative office of the courts by appointing its director, who assigns judges to various courts, controls salaries and personnel, and manages the state court system in general. Justices Bobbitt and Carlisle W. Higgins both urge Sharp to run. She is the next most senior justice and the traditional heir apparent, 67 years old, with a dozen years of experience on the Supreme Court. "Now that the die is cast, I'm scared again," she confides to a former colleague. "In following Judge Bobbitt, I could only be an anticlimax." Few there are who have his wisdom, learning, temperament, and character, and I am not in his class. Today, the Chief Justice has many duties in addition to writing the same number of opinions as the other justices, and you know what a slow writer I am. Her Republican opponent is James M. Newcomb, a white man with no legal training or political experience. He defeats a well-qualified and experienced black district court judge, Alretta Melton Alexander, in the Republican primary, stunning Democrats and Republicans alike. Sharp runs an exhausting and effective campaign, calling on every political ally she can muster. And in November 1974, she becomes the first woman ever to be elected Chief Justice of a state Supreme Court. Her mandate is astonishing, 74% of the vote. Having continued to live in her childhood home with her parents while practicing law, Sharp moved to Raleigh only after she was appointed judge, first to the Hotel Sir Walter on Fayetteville Street, such a favorite haunt of legislatures that at one point it became an informal home to the state Democratic Party and later in her first apartment. She travels extensively, enjoying Broadway shows in New York, trips to Europe, and a cruise to Nova Scotia with colleagues. She remains something of an enigma, outwardly controlled, proper, and cheerful, but also suffering chronic cramping and headaches from a condition known as dysmenorrhea, so severe that she undergoes surgery and at one point entertains the idea of bearing a child as a remedy. But nothing seems to slow her down. She's a quiet dynamo, and in real sense, her professional passion becomes dispassion, the ability to separate her own opinions and prejudices from her absolute fealty to the law. Sharp is no crusader for social justice. Her family-inherited segregationist views are well-known, and her attitudes become, if anything, more conservative over time. For the North Carolina Supreme Court, Sharp authors 459 majority opinions. One is a 1964 decision upholding the right of a theater owner in Fayetteville to have arrested and prosecuted three black men who dared to sit in the whites-only orchestra section rather than in the balcony after a white man purchased tickets for them. In 1973, she answers a student query. At one time in my life, when I was much younger, I was violently opposed to capital punishment. After I went on the bench and my experience broadened, I began to change my mind. Under the conditions prevailing today, I think we should carefully weigh the consequences before we abolish capital punishment for first-degree murder and rape. Yet that same year, she joins Chief Justice Bobbitt and Associate Justice Higgins in challenging a majority opinion upholding the death penalty on the case of a convicted rapist, based on a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling invalidating it as cruel and unusual punishment prohibited by the Constitution. She writes that, "Were I to permit my personal views on capital punishment as a state policy to dictate my decision in this case, I would have voted with the majority." Following the law without regard for her personal views becomes her trademark, and her legacy thus is surprisingly progressive. In Hall v. Wake County Board of Elections, she upholds, under certain conditions, a student's right to vote where she is attending college. And in an exhaustively researched and lengthy opinion in Smith v. State, Sharp upholds the appeal court's decision to allow the superintendent of Broughton Hospital, terminated 3 years before the term of his contract expired, to sue for lost wages, seriously limiting the traditional doctrine of state sovereign immunity. She takes a hard line on judicial misconduct, ruling that ousted District Court Judge Linwood T. Peoples would not be allowed to take office as a Superior Court judge, and that other sanctions would be imposed. Sharp notes that it would indeed be a travesty if a judge could avoid the full consequences of his misconduct by resigning from office after removal proceedings had been brought against him. When Susie Sharp retires in 1979, women lawyers and judges are no longer a novelty. Through unrelenting hard work, she has used her keen intelligence and political savvy to create a pathway for other women to follow, stalwartly maintaining that being a woman was an advantage, not a hindrance, to her success. Former Chief Justice James G. Exum Jr. tells her biographer Anna R. Hayes, she was impartial, she was dispassionate, she did the job the way they expected it to be done, and she was good at it. That's the end of the article. Next month, Soul City, an experimental town in Warren County. And I suppose after that we'll start a new decade. This was the 70s, so will we move on to the 80s in January? We shall see. Last week, we only got partway through an article entitled Can't Miss Cabins and Cottages. They were a series of short reviews, if you will, of various cottages and cabins around the state, and we will continue where we left off. And that would be Caffey's Inlet Life Saving Station in Duck. As shipping traffic increased in the years following the Civil War, many ships were lost in the perilous waters off North Carolina's coast. In 1874, Caffey's Inlet Lifesaving Station was established as one of seven such outposts on the Outer Banks. Servicemen lived and worked in the wood-shingled cottage, keeping watch from a hipped roof lookout tower. The station was abandoned in the late 1950s as modern equipment and a decline in the use of sailing vessels reduced the number of shipwrecks in the area. Today, Sanderling Resort operates the site as the Lifesaving Station Restaurant, which serves a seasonal meal of southern coastal fare made with regionally sourced ingredients. They're on Duck Road in Duck, and they have a website, sanderling-resort.com. And how about Camp Mary Wood? That's M-E-R-R-I-E hyphen Wood with an E on the end, in Sapphire. Camp Mary Wood, at the base of Bald Rock Mountain in Sapphire Valley, was established as Lake Fairfield Camp in 1919 amid a national movement that saw increased outdoor recreation and education opportunities for girls. As more women matriculated into colleges and universities and fought for their right to vote, camp directors strove to instill in young women self-reliance and strong character. The oldest of Mary Wood's Adirondack-style cabins date from 1919 to 1922, and they continue to shelter adventure-seeking girls and young women each summer. They're in Sapphire. Their web address is marywood.com. And now we have the Zebulon B. Vance birthplace in Weaverville. Former North Carolina Governor and U.S. Senator Zebulon B. Vance was born on a remote farm in Reams Creek Valley in 1830. Part of the land for the farm was originally purchased by Zebulon's grandfather, David Vance Sr., with a land grant that was issued as payment for his service in the American Revolution. Today, visitors can tour the reconstructed log cabin called a saddlebag house because of its layout of two rooms on either side of a central chimney, with its original circa 1795 fireplace, as well as a loom house, tool shed, spring house, smokehouse, corn crib, and quarters for enslaved people. On display are farm tools such as a hay fork and a bow yoke. Domestic tools such as an iron and cooking utensils and a clock, a rare possession of the time and an indicator of the wealth and prominence of the Vance family. They're on Reams Creek Road in Weaverville, and they have such a long website address, I'm going to just say look up Zebulon B. Vance birthplace on Google. And now we have Bennett Place State Historical Site in Durham. On April 26, 1865, Confederate General Joseph E. Johnson and Union General William T. Sherman met at the home of James and Nancy Bennett. The original spelling was I-T-T at the end, as opposed to E-T-T as it is now, to negotiate what would become the largest troop surrender of the Civil War, effectively ending the fighting in the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida. Although the farmhouse and kitchen burned down in 1921, the buildings were reconstructed in the 1960s around an original stone chimney and are open for both guided and self-guided tours. They're on Bennett Memorial Road in Durham, Bennett Place Historic Site.com. And now the Brinegar Cabin in Trap Hill. Located in what is now the Blue Ridge Parkway, Brinegar Cabin was built by Martin Brinegar and his wife Caroline in the 1880s. The two-room, one-and-a-half-story cabin with clapboard sidings, wooden shingles, two dry-stacked chimneys, and a stone foundation is a surviving example of construction methods used by early electricity in North Carolina's remote regions. The cabin rests on what was a 125-acre farm where the Brinegar family maintained livestock, gardens, and an apple orchard. They grew, collected, and made the things they needed, living a nearly self-sufficient lifestyle. Caroline made the family's clothing, weaving linsey-woolsey cloth on a four-poster hand loom that had been a wedding gift from her father. Martin earned a little money as a cobbler, selling shoes for about a dollar a pair. Caroline and the children collected herbs to sell to merchants in Jefferson and Boone. Today, the cabin, cellar, springhouse, and a garden are open to visitors as an interpretive exhibit offering a glimpse into Appalachian farm life from 1885 to 1935. They're on the Blue Ridge Parkway at milepost 238 in Trap Hill. And Caudill Cabin at Doughton Park is next there in Laurel Springs. Built in 1890, Caudill Cabin in Basin Cove was home to Martin and Janie Caudill and the first six of their children before the family moved to Virginia in 1906. In Basin Cove, they grew crops, raised livestock, hunted game, and made clothing and quilts from wool and flax produced on their farm. In July of 1916, not long after the Caudills returned to Basin Cove, two tropical storms swept through the Appalachian Mountain within days of each other. After the first storm saturated the soil and swelled the streams, the second brought record-breaking floods and massive landslides, destroying most of the houses and farmland. Miraculously, Caudill Cabin survived. Today, it can be visited by hiking 3.3 miles along Doughton Park's waterfall-lined Basin Creek Trail. They're on milepost 238.5 through 241 in Laurel Springs, North Carolina. And now we have the Nathaniel Macon House in Littleton. Nathaniel Macon was born in 1758 on his father's tobacco plantation in the Shoco Creek area in what is today Warren County. After joining the militia to fight the British in the American Revolution, Macon was elected to the state Senate in 1781. From there, he went on to hold seats in both the U.S. House of Representatives, where he served as Speaker of the House from 1801 to 1807, and the U.S. Senate. During his nearly five-decade political career, he became known as an advocate for states' rights and for North Carolina's agricultural interests. Although his home was destroyed by a fire in 1977, a replica was constructed on his historic plantation, now Buck Spring Park. Visitors can also view a log corn crib, a smokehouse, and Macon's gravesite across the street, and enjoy mountain biking and hiking trails, a playground, and a fishing pier. They're on Nathaniel Macon Drive in Littleton. No website. And coming near the end now, the Andrew Johnson birthplace in Raleigh. Although no proof has been discovered to verify the birthplace of the 17th President of the United States, local lore has it that Andrew Johnson was born in a small one-story house with a loft in the heart of Raleigh in 1809. Mystery aside, the house is interesting in its own right, in that it is fairly well-traveled for a house. Believed by architectural experts to have been built in the late 1700s as a kitchen and then converted into a cottage, the house was moved four times. It was finally relocated to Mordecai Historic Park in 1975, where it can now be toured as part of a collection of structures that depict early life in Raleigh. One Mimosa Street. What a nice name. Raleigh. And they don't have a website either. Very small place. It's kind of a coffee-colored siding on it, and a simple front door with a steep front step, and a great big chimney on one end of the house, and a window on the second floor. And finally, historic Beach Cottage Row, Nag's Head. By the time of the Civil War, Nag's Head had become a popular resort destination among the planters and merchants of the state's northeastern counties. It wasn't until after the war, however, that development reached the ocean side of the island. The cottages in historic Beach Cottage Row, several of which are available as vacation rentals, date from just after the Civil War to the early 1900s. Despite their range in age, they share many similarities, including expansive porches for cooling off in the sea breeze, and most notably the wood-shingled exteriors that earn these homes the nickname the Unpainted Aristocracy. We have a checklist here entitled Go Fish. 10 seafood markets make eating hook to fork a breeze no matter where you are in the state. It's a picture of Clyde Phillips Seafood Market here. I think that's in Southport. Okay, on the western side, we have Mother Ocean Seafood Market in Asheville. Owner Sam Kosick used to drive across the state once a week to pick up just-caught fish from the coast. Today, Mother Ocean supplies loyal customers with the freshest seafood every day. High Country Seafood in West Jefferson. What started out as a small fish stand on the side of a mountain road is now a favorite market and restaurant in the West. Enjoy a classic shrimp po' boy at a picnic table on Beaver Creek School Road. In the central area, in High Point, we have the Shrimp Connection. Piedmont-based seafood connoisseurs know that this market sells the freshest fish and shellfish they can get without catching it themselves. Locals Seafood in Raleigh. This landlocked crew drives to the coast 3 to 4 times a week to buy super fresh seafood straight from the source. Be sure to pick up a peck of oysters. They're in Farmers Market Drive. Forsyth Seafood Market and Cafe in Winston-Salem. At this market and cafe founded by Beaufort natives, who know a thing about seafood? Just pick a fish and the chef will cook it up for you right then and there. On the eastern side of the state, Atlantic Beach Seafood and Fresh Market. Whether you're eating in or taking home a steamer pot for a low country boil, the owners keep things as fresh as possible. In Elizabeth City, it's Quality Seafood Market. This family-owned market and restaurant within sight of the Pascatank River sells local fish and shellfish alongside a full menu of home-style diners. And in Kinston, it's Reynolds Seafood Company. Since opening its doors in 1960, this distinctive market near the Neuse River has become a destination for a wide variety of seafood. The Austin Fish Company in Nag's Head. This Outer Banks retailer and restaurant offers a variety of options like fried lunch favorites on the porch and wild-caught fish for your dinner. And finally, Clyde, let's see if I was right. Oh, I was wrong. Clyde Phillips Seafood Market is not where South, I think I said it was in South something or other, but it's in Swansboro, another favorite town of mine. This decades-old mainstay located where the White Oak River splits has sent many a snapper, flounder, pound of shrimp, and bushels of oysters out the door. And out the door we go, recording this on the day before Thanksgiving. When you hear it, I hope you had a fantastic time with family and friends. And I hope you enjoyed the broadcast today. Be sure to listen next week. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community so many years. Since 1974, you know they can be trusted. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.